Welcome to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm your host, Carl Morand. Today I'm talking with Ali Ansari, author of the new book, The Politics of Nationalism in Modern Iran. The book traces the nationalist movement in Iran from the Tobacco Revolt of 1891 up to the current government led by President Ahmadinejad. Ansari explains how the events of the early 20th century led to the more well-known events of Iran's recent history, providing detailed insight into the key people that have been a part of Iran's nationalist movement. The book explains the internal struggles that the movement has faced in the past century, along with outside influences that have affected its development. Ali, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. If you could you start out by giving us a little bit of a background on yourself and what led you to write this book?
Well, thank you for having me. My background is Iranian. So I actually came to the United Kingdom just before the revolution. My parents were sending me to boarding school here. I then developed an interest in history and found, really, as I was going through my university education, that I could obviously do something more specialized on Iran, partly because I had a deep interest in that, and it was a sort of a niche area, really, compared to what most people were doing. But also, as I went on to do my PhD research, I was obviously had Persian and could apply that and could access sources that maybe other people couldn't. But more than that, I suppose I had a cultural access that in some ways other people might not have had. So my research has really been down the sort of the route of what we would loosely term modern Iranian history. And I think my PhD work had been broadly in the areas of ideology and nationalism in Iran. So this latest work, rather belatedly, I have to say, is really the my effort at turning what was a modest PhD dissertation into a hopefully a readable and provocative book.
Excellent. In the book, you talk about the tobacco revolt as being the moment of national awakening and sort of the start of the nationalist movement. Could you talk about the influence that revolt had?
Well, what I try to suggest in the book is that really this is the standard orthodox narrative of when sort of nationalism as a political movement of mass mobilization starts in Iran. And it's really a signpost that is laid down by the noted British scholar of Iran, Edward Brown, who was then actually professor of Arabic in Cambridge, but really is the father of Persian studies in the UK. And he was the one that really, looking at the constitutional revolution a decade or so afterwards, pointed to the roots of this constitutional movement in the tobacco revolt of the early 1890s. And I was, you know, I say that this is as good a place as any to start, although in the book I try to deconstruct that and to show that in many ways that's quite an artificial beginning, and it's a beginning that a start that really was laid down by a British writer, a European writer, who then whose writings were effectively sort of digested and endorsed by a number of other Iranian writers who came after him. But in many ways, we can look further back to see the roots, the sort of the cultural, or even, to quote Anthony Smith, the ethnic roots of Iranian nationalism go back some way further.
You mentioned the British. Could you talk about the influence that European society and European governments had during the initial stages of the nationalist movement in Iran?
Well, one of the things I argue is that traditionally nationalisms in the Middle East, not just in Iran, are seen as antagonistic to Western colonialism, Western imperialism, and they tend to be seen in conjunction as a sort of an attempt to sort of free from the shackles of imperialism, and therefore very much defined against Europe. What I've tried to say is that the relationship is a good deal more subtle than that, and that this black and white relationship simply did not exist. That what you had was a series of intellectuals, in Iran in this case, who, yes, wanted to find a way to reinvigorate what they consider to be rather stale political and social systems in their countries, but that they were very much shaped by a vocabulary that they inherited from Europe. And what I argue is that this vocabulary came from the European Enlightenment, largely the 18th century European Enlightenment, and drawn really from a lexicon that shaped the Anglo-American Enlightenment of the period. It's not something that people look at too much. We tend to always see that nationalisms were born in the French Revolution, and it was the French view of the nation and the state that was adopted by Middle Eastern nationalists. So I'm trying to shift that focus slightly differently, and to say actually there were other legacies that they drew on. That's not to say there wasn't an antagonistic relationship to some extent with the Europeans, certainly in their political manifestations and their attempts to control resources in the Middle East. But it's just to also argue that the relationship was not quite as confrontational as some later nationalists would have us believe.
Interesting. I think, yes, many people would be surprised to read about the connections with the American Revolution and the American sort of experiment.
One of the things, if I can elaborate on this, is that quite a few nationalists, and this also applies to the early nationalists, it also applies to the Ottoman Empire, to Iran, had joined the Freemasons. Now, if you join the Freemasons and you belong to what they consider to be this sort of international or transnational sort of intellectual brotherhood, you bought into certain ideas. You bought into certain ideas about religion and superstition. You bought into certain ideas about liberalism, progressiveness, so on and so forth. The notion of government, what it means to be a republic, put that in inverted commas because it has very particular meanings at the time. Basically, a government, a central government restricted by law. And what they emphasize is that in order to progress, you need, and what I argue in the book, is this move, as in Europe, from a republic of letters to a republic of laws. This is very much derived from a sort of an Enlightenment project, which we see reaching fruition during the American Revolution, but also in a sort of a Whig tradition that you see in Great Britain. And, of course, other countries in Europe also adopt certain of these ideas. But it's actually not entirely indebted to the sort of the French model of the post-French revolutionary period. It does have a debt elsewhere. And that's simply what I'm trying to highlight. And it's very clear. It's very clear in the writings of many of these individuals that the model they look for is a sort of a constitutional government in which government is limited by the rule of law. And that's what they really obsess about. So it's an interesting development and an interesting legacy, and one that regrettably has largely been lost in more recent scholarship.
What do you think, going back in time to the early 20th century, would have been the ideal system that the revolutionaries would have tried to put in place if they, if wishing would make it so?
Well, I think they were fixated on the notion of a republic. And a republic could be either the model that was taken in the United States, or, and this was their preference, I would suggest, really a republic on the model of the constitutional monarchy that was developed in Great Britain. And what this meant really is obviously the monarch restricted by laws, in which it's a parliamentary system and a separation of powers. These individuals drew heavily on the writings of people of the 18th century Enlightenment. They were, interestingly enough, very fond of David Hume, which was quite a surprise to me actually at the time, because David Hume is a well-known atheist. The reason they liked him is because he really challenged this notion of superstition, really, in the way in political systems worked. But also they drew on French writers such as Montesquieu. They were other writers such as Voltaire. They didn't always get to grips with them as well as they could have. But what was interesting to me is that they were more familiar with them than I had initially thought. And their model, really, again, as I said, was this was the imposition of a legal system, which they defined as a republic, but didn't necessarily mean the removal of the monarchy. In fact, they often felt that a monarchy had to exist, in part to keep the traditional sentiments of Iranian society in check as well, to satisfy a certain yearning, but it had to be legally restricted.
Do you think they saw the continuation of a monarchy as sort of a temporary measure to maintain stability, or was that something that they envisioned long-term would stay in place?
Well, it's very interesting because there seemed to be some debate among Iranian nationalists as to how they should proceed. a very interesting little vignette that comes out is in 1924, when they start to discuss about, you know, an abolition of the monarchy and to set up a republic in its purest form. What they do is they go and scrutinize the American Constitution. So they go start reading it and find out, you know, what can we learn from this? Brief moment, I have to say. I think, by and large, most of them are realistic enough to know that what they need is a monarchy that's basically represents authority, the consolidation of authority, before they can move to another stage. I mean, what bothered them in many ways was their attempt at constitutional government faltered on the fact that actually they didn't have good government in place in the first place. There was no point restricting an authority that had no authority. So what you had to do is to actually step backwards and establish good governance. And this could often be of an authoritarian nature. But the fact is, if you didn't have a consolidated, unified authority, you couldn't then move on to stage two, which was to restrict it. In the American case, of course, the Americans had inherited a political system from Britain. So therefore, you know, they could move straight on to stage two, which is restricting it. From the Iranian case, they felt actually that they had no central government, and therefore they had to build central government in the first place. And as a result, this is why when the Pahlavis come in, when Reza Khan becomes Reza Shah, he is actually widely supported by the intelligentsia, because he's seen as the strong man who can restore a sort of central authority and bring centralized government to Iran, which can then be constitutionally limited. Of course, in that case, the limitations were never really imposed. They were able to get through stage one, but not really much down the route to stage two.
Could you talk a bit about Takhzadeh and particularly his list of prescriptions, which I found very interesting to read, and his influence on the nationalist movement?
Takhzadeh is an enormously controversial figure, but he's controversial in large parts because he's not only an intellectual, he's also an activist. And the truth is, when you mix the academy with politics, you always get controversy. I mean, there will be people who always criticize what he did, or at times what he said. He's not the only person to have laid down these prescriptions. There was another group that did something quite similar. But his have become very famous, largely because of one prescription, and I think it's number three on the list, where he says that Iranians must adopt all the means of European civilization. And that's an important qualification, by the way. European civilization, both sort of mentally or rationally, some people translate it as spiritually, it depends how you want to translate the words, and in sort of cultural terms. I mean, basically materially and in terms of of thought processes. Now, people have said that this is a horrendous, you know, I mean, this is, they've argued very strongly that, you know, this shows how he'd sold out basically to foreign powers. Of course, what most people do is they take that one prescription outside the other 26 or so he has. If you look at the others and you put it in context, you'll see at the same time he says one must protect the Persian language, one must promote history. Well, you know, I mean, he basically is quite clear that, you know, he's not saying for a wholesale, basically, adoption of European values as a whole. The key, I think, to understanding him, and this is what why I argue very strongly for this idea of the Enlightenment, is his preoccupation with the concept of civilization. That what he's saying is that Iranians need to adopt essentially the norms of civilization, in this case, as he sees it, the continent that has achieved most so far as European civilization. He's not talking about European culture as a whole. It's really about taking on the manners and the attitudes of this sort of most advanced civilization. And effectively, if you look at the term of reference he uses, returning it, you know, coming back to Iran, he's almost saying that we had this civilization, we have forsaken it, now we need to get it back. And of course, Takhzadeh himself admits, I mean, the phrase itself was actually borrowed from a Kurdish nationalist. It wasn't his, he just adapted it. But he admits that it was a fairly provocative thing to say, and that, you know, had he had his time again, he might have used slightly different words. But he does say that at the time when he put it in 1921, the situation was so bad that, in his own words, he said, I had to throw a sort of an intellectual hand grenade into there and get people to wake up to realize how bad things were. So this, again, I think, is one of the problems, as I said, of mixing politics with sort of intellectual life, and one of the misreadings that comes. He, you know, later on in life did admit that it was probably a statement too far in terms of the words he used. But of course, as I said, there was another set of prescriptions that had been issued by another group, I think the Young Iranians or something, or Young Iran Group, and they were very similar. They didn't use quite the same provocative language, but they were very similar. And these represent really the clearest sort of the clearest manifesto for Iranian nationalism that we have. A lot of people complain that there wasn't one, but there clearly was, and they'd written, you know, there were long formulations. And if you look at them in the context of their time, they're very heavily influenced by this sort of ideas of the Enlightenment. I mean, education is absolutely central. Education is fundamental to this. In order for us to get out of the mess we're in, we need to educate our public.
Do you think there possibly, you mentioned that he, you know, later in life, wished he had, I guess, expressed it differently. Do you think there would be there was a way for him to express that sentiment that wouldn't have garnered so much negative reaction?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think if you'd gone the similar way to how the others had done it. But at the time, I mean, his problem is that he was a very provocative thinker. He was quite a controversial political figure. And I mean, to be perfectly honest, the reason why he's been much maligned in retrospect is because many people on the left, both on the sort of hard left and the hard right, if I may put it that way, really disliked him. I mean, they saw him as too Anglophile. They saw him as someone who'd was emblematic of everything that they'd come to dislike. In fact, as an example of his time, what he said was not actually that shocking. I mean, that's what's interesting. In the context of his time, I think the early nationalists were far keener or far more willing to engage in self-criticism than later nationalists were, who became, you know, much more sensitive to this sort of sense of cultural superiority. I mean, Thierry Zaudet and his compatriots at the time were much more willing to basically take a scalpel, in a sense, to their own society and culture and say, you know, what have we done wrong that we need to put right? Later nationalists were unwilling to do that. They just basically sought to, you know, push a sort of a doctrine of pride, really, is all that can be said, and to say that, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. It's all to do with the West. Well, you know, for Thierry Zaudet and his generation, particularly in the aftermath of the First World War, this was simply not the case.
It almost seems as though his analysis was possibly more grounded in reality, or more willing to change and adapt, as opposed to just insisting that the way thing, you know, that the status quo is okay and we can make this work.
Well, what's fascinating about Thierry Zaudet and that generation is that, you know, if you'd asked me this question, you know, 20 years ago, I would probably have still sort of said, you know, he was wrong and he'd sold out too much to the West. I mean, you could see that attitude, and certainly in Iran in the aftermath of the Islamic Revolution, where there was a heightened sort of sense of, you know, self-achievement, independence, so on and so forth. You know, Thierry Zaudet was part of a generation that got it wrong. Interestingly, now, I mean, if you, all history being contemporary history, if you look at it from the perspective of what's going on in the Islamic Republic today, there are many people who are far more willing to give Thierry Zaudet a second hearing. And this is what's fascinating. And not only Thierry Zaudet, even Reza Shah, people who up until about 20 years ago would have been condemned outright as a generation that sold out, and now being looked at, picked up and looked at and saying, well, maybe they had a point. You know, maybe, you know, we haven't got grips with our problems, and that's why I think Thierry Zaudet is actually on the way back.
Could you talk a little bit? You mentioned David Hume.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about the influence that religion had for the early nationalists and the sort of balance they tried to strike with regards to religion and governance?
Well, one of the great myths of the early nationalists is that they were a-religious, or actually atheistic. And, you know, they were against religion and they, you know, radical nationalists, secular, so on and so forth. I think, you know, what we've been what recent scholarship has shown and what I've tried to sort of extend is this view that, first of all, being secular doesn't mean you're atheistic. I mean, there was a view that being secular meant that, but that's certainly not the case. I think a lot of them were what we would broadly call secular, again, in the Anglo-American model, not in the French model. That is, that there should be a separation of religion from politics, but religion is an important part of life. It just shouldn't be politicized. This is quite different from the French model, which you can see, you know, replicated in Turkey, at least until recently. Now, this view that these early nationalists were all anti-religious is simply not true. I mean, the mere fact that a large majority were Freemasons will provide you, you know, with evidence of that. What they were really against, and this is where David Hume, or the ideas of David Hume as they understood it, it has to be said, because I'm not sure how familiar they were exactly with his ideas. But where David Hume became useful was their distinction between a proper religion and what they understood as superstition. And superstition also was associated much more with the clerical hierarchy. So they were very, very anti the Orthodox faith, which obviously brought them in conflict with the ulama, with the mullahs. But they were not irreligious. Quite clearly, they were not irreligious. You see that in a lot of their writings. And Tahrirzadeh actually is quite clear on this. I mean, Tahrirzadeh almost has a sort of later in life as a slight reaction to it, or he thinks that what he's unleashed is perhaps something that he, or what he helped unleash is perhaps not what he'd intended. And he sees that sort of radical, almost atheistic secularism, if I can put it that way, in the later 20th century really worries him. I mean, he thinks it's bad that we forgo religion altogether. And he says that's important. If you look at the early nationalists, they're all on this wavelength. They say religion, yes, superstition, no. Superstition is holding us back. But religion, properly constructed and understood, is useful. And the greatest example of this, by the way, is the individual who's generally considered to be the father of political Islam, Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani. Afghani himself was also a Freemason, but also argued very heavily against superstition and ignorance amongst the religious classes, and had a very enlightened view of what religion and, quote, philosophy was about, or were about, beg your pardon. And he argues that, I mean, it's interesting, his disciples tend to take from him what they want, but if you look at his writings as a whole, he saw religion as a useful means of achieving political sort of liberation, if you will. But he was strongly, strongly antithetical to what he considered to be orthodox, dogmatic, superstitious religion.
You mentioned that arguably the revolution of 1979 simply unleashed the potential of the late Pahlavi state by removing what limited restrictions on action remained. Could you talk about what you view were the precursors of the 1979 revolution, particularly as they date farther back to the early nationalists, because I imagine most people have a view of the 1979 revolution being just directly related to the history that immediately preceded it.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a narrative of the Islamic revolution that tends to see it as a reaction to what may have gone on in the constitutional revolution, or, as I say, the atheism or secularism of the earlier period. I tend to look at it slightly differently. What I'm basically arguing is that the early nationalists had a constitutional project, and the constitutional project is twofold: create good governance, and good governance must be matched by accountability and rights, so a legal system that restricts the power of government and also protects the rights of citizens. What really happens in the late Pahlavi state is that second part of the project is not fulfilled. So although the state is built and becomes more and more powerful, the protection for citizens is never really institutionalized in the law. And one of the things I draw attention to is that the great legal reforms that took place in the 1920s and 30s under Reza Shah and his very energetic Minister of Justice, a gentleman by the name of Ali Akbar Davar, who really sort of effectively invented the Iranian judiciary out of nothing. I mean, there were precedents for this, but he effectively put it in. What he effectively did was provide the new state with legal muscle. But the second aspect of that reform, which was to protect the citizenry with sort of rights in the face of this stronger state, were not achieved. They weren't achieved by the time Reza Shah was deposed, and his son also failed to really move ahead with this, such that in the Islamic Revolution, what you have is charismatic leadership, which basically is not constitutional in a way in which the nationalists had previously thought. It's predicated in some ways on the idea of monarchy as that Mohammad Reza Shah had developed. So Reza Shah's son also moved into the realms of a sort of a spiritual religious monarchy, and he had some rather vague and perhaps woolly notions of what a monarch was meant to be about, but it was all about some sort of a divine right, and the father knew best, and so on and so forth. It certainly didn't involve the law in any way that the early nationalists had. So what you have effectively is a strong state, increasingly strong state, by the end of the 20th century, financed with oil wealth, which is giving that centralized authority a much more power. And then in the revolution, of course, any other restriction that might have even been in theory put on it, be it, Western opprobrium, the Shah at least had a desire not to offend anyone abroad. In the Islamic Republic, even that's discarded. And what you have is a guardianship of the jurists, this velite-fari system, replacing the monarchy, but with much, much more extensive powers. So in a sense, you have a modern state with this charismatic leader on top of it who can exploit it to the full. I mean, basically, he is able to use this state in any way he sees fit without any sense that there are restrictions on his power. And to add to that, by the way, the religious zeal that comes through in this early period, it gives the Pahlavi state a huge amount of dynamism and energy. Unfortunately, and this is the bit that most people don't get, they don't reinvest in the Pahlavi state. They take a lot out of it. They don't reinvest in its institutional structures, such that we get to a situation now where actually the state as was being built in the 1920s and 30s is almost derelict. I mean, it has very few systems of accountability or checks and balances or anything remaining. And it's become a very personality-led government.
That's interesting, because you mentioned in the early stages they were looking for sort of a strong central leader, strong central government to then be able to sort of impose checks and balances and, limits. And it seems as if they've achieved the strong central governance and then almost just sort of blown through that without the ability to have any restraints placed on it.
That's exactly the problem. Is basically what they've done is they've achieved stage one, but we're never able to get round to stage two. And there were obviously different reasons that that caused this. I mean, many of the early nationalists obviously didn't live long enough. I mean, let's give you one example. I mean, one of the reasons that they were not, that they were much more enthusiastic in some ways about strong government was they simply said, we don't have an educated public. How can we have a republic or a democracy when nobody's educated, nobody can read or write or whatever? So what we need to do is establish education on a massive scale. Now, in order to do a lot of these big, big projects that they needed, big sort of institutionalized projects, not infrastructure in a economic sense, but infrastructure in a social and educational sense, you need someone strong at the helm who can push all these things through. So they got that bit. And of course, ironically, then get a relatively educated public. I mean, now, if you look at Iran today, it's one of the most literate societies in the world. But actually, they haven't matched it with anything political to match the demands. And you see this increasingly with people in Iran. We talk about this middle class, but it's more than that, really. You talk about all these, literate people who are then saying, well, we actually want to share in what's going on, but we want to participate in politics. But of course, that's excluded to them. It's that part of the sort of the accountability has been stripped of them. And it's one of the great tragedies of modern Iranian nationalism is that it's lost sight of the very reason that it was developed, and that is the people. The people themselves are absent from Iranian nationalism. And you hear this all the time, people talking about the rights of Iran and the right of Iran to do this, to enrich uranium, to have its influence in such and such a place, the right of Iran to do that. And yet nobody really talks about the rights of Iranians. I mean, if you look at that, there's no talk about it at all. I mean, they're not interested. Everything is subsumed to the nation. But who is the nation? Well, the nation seems to be defined by one or two people at the top.
How do you think, you mentioned that many of the early nationalists obviously didn't live long enough to see the 79 revolution, how do you think they would have viewed it, and particularly the establishment of the Islamic Republic?
I think, in all honesty, they would have been horrified. This is exactly what they were trying to avoid. What the Islamic Republic represented in many ways was a union of the radical left and the radical right, but with a heavy element of religious reactionism. And it was this religious reactionism that would have appalled them. I mean, this is what they were hoping education would prevent, because they were well aware. And if you go back to the 19th century, you have the Babi revolt. The Babi revolt is a millenarian movement that then gives way to the Baha'i religion that we now know. Now, a lot of them, while they were horrified at the level of violence meted out to the Babis and later the Baha'is, and thought this was astonishing behavior for a civilized society, they also were very critical of the fact that in, quote, a modern country, someone could come up and claim to be the Messiah. I mean, they sort of said, this is just superstition. What the hell are we doing? We have to find a way to educate ourselves out of this sort of superstition. I mean, they had this very ambivalent, relationship to Babism in that respect. It both provoked a good reaction, but it also generated a certain amount of skepticism and uneasiness. And I think this dislike of these sort of religious movements would have meant that the 1979 revolution, when Khomeini was being, apparently, his face was seen in the moon, and, bits of his beard were being found in pages of the Quran and this sort of thing. Horrifying.
You mentioned that everything is subsumed to the nation, and that the rights of actual Iranians is not really considered. Mm. How do you feel that people in Iran would view the assertions by their government that Iran, has certain rights to, like you said, enrich uranium or exert influence in various places? Do you think they feel that that's representing them, and that they are, that their sort of wishes, or that they're being represented well by their government?
Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons, in a way, that I wrote the book, is I was always very struck that Iranians, on the surface at least, can appear extremely nationalistic. I mean, it's a way of, showing a degree of loyalty to a political system. And, of course, Tahrirzadeh and others had a term for this. He called these people professional patriots. He said they do it almost as a job, but they don't really understand what it means. It's just an indication of loyalty. And I think, Iranians are very sensible to this notion. Some of them are very emotional about it, even among the diaspora, by the way, not necessarily within Iran itself. In fact, in some ways, I think in the diaspora, when they don't have to live in Iran, are probably more nationalistic in some ways than those within the country. I think in the country, there are strong opinions as to what nationalism really means. And I think there's a strong sense of agreement about, the right to enrich uranium. But I think many young nationalists now in Iran also say there are many other rights that are completely ignored, and you can't subsume everything down the right to enrich uranium or the right to do something in a very abstract way without actually dealing with very tangible individual civil rights. It seems to be a big contradiction for them, and I think there's a lot of skepticism among certainly sort of intellectual nationalists, if I can put it that way, those who've looked at this in a bit more depth, and also among, say, students and others, at the government's claims at the moment to be representing the nation. But it's also an interesting reflection on where the Islamic Republic is going, because, of course, they've depended on three aspects of legitimacy, principally, of course, Islam. Then they've argued also that they're a republic. Well, those two planks have largely been knocked down. I mean, they have very little credibility in the field of, projecting Islam. I mean, because a number of things they say are so strange, according to standard Islamic doctrine, that people find it quite awkward. Well, the Republican element has also been, knocked down. I mean, if you look at the 2009 elections, it doesn't look good for them. So the one thing they have to rely on now is nationalism, and they've obviously been using that, with wild abandon. And of course, it works. And one of the things I say in the book is I say, if religion was the opium of the masses, well, nationalism has proved to be a much more energizing drug, and the government uses. And it works, it works. But I think when people sit down and think and they say, well, what does it mean to be Iranian? you know, why is it important to be, you know, when you think about what does it mean to be American, most people will say, well, you know, I have certain rights, you know, I can do certain things. I'm proud to be this because, you know, I have a relationship with the state represents me, so on and so forth. Well, in Iran, they can't say that at the moment. And, you know, this idea that we're all proud to be Iranian simply because either we were born there or because the earth is very nice or has nice mountains or nice buildings or the history is great, so on and so forth. Well, I mean, that's all very well and nice, but it's not really satisfying in a modern context.
So do you think the people who are very passionately nationalistic in Iran, are they just sort of blindly supporting it as sort of viewing, okay, I'm Iranian, so I have to support Iran? Or do they think that the things the Iranian state is doing does sort of advance their interest or represent them, or they have pride in what the Iranian government does?
It's a bit of both, but I think increasingly the government is losing that ability to convince people that it's doing things in their national interest. I mean, there is a bit of both, and I mean it's you know the government in Iran is heavily helped by some of the rhetoric that comes out of the United States or Israel or other places, and you know, of course, you know, people will always rally around what they consider familiar. But, you know, an American friend of mine would always say, I mean, one of the hostages, in actual fact, at the time, he always used to comment on how perverse the whole situation was, that on the one hand, they'd be shouting all sorts of obscenities against the United States or the West and, you know, championing Iranian nationalism. And almost with the next breath would tell him, you know, can I have a visa? Now, you know, this sort of contradiction is you know, shows that actually even the nationalism that exists in Iran is perhaps what we might term a soft nationalism. It serves a political purpose, but it's amazing how flexible it can be when push comes to shove. And I think this is what Taghizadeh argued against, and this is where he's very useful. I mean, he says, you know, patriotism, I think I quoted some of the book, he says, you know, patriotism, or brackets nationalism, I translate as patriotism, cannot be imposed from above. It can only be built on the foundations of justice. And I think so. I can't remember the exact quote. But he basically says it can, real patriotism, real nationalism can only be built from the base up. And really, again, through a sense of social justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like any nationalism or patriotism that is imposed would be short-lived and artificial and wouldn't receive much, you know, strong support.
It's amazing in the sense that I have to say that in Iran, it's, you know, one of the fascinating things for me, and I say in the introduction, is how nationalism as an ideology is so pervasive in the discourse of the country. I mean, you know, when they want to abuse you in Iran, they don't call you an infidel or don't call you a slur, a sort of religious slur. They always call you a traitor. I mean, you know, that's, you know, the language is all, whether it be praise or whether it be abuse, is always done in the language of whether you're whether you're a true patriot or true nationalist or not. What I've tried to do in the book is to really say, well, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? This language is used very loosely, but what does it mean, really, you know, to be an Iranian in the modern age? And I think the early nationalists had a pretty good shot at it, actually. I mean, I think they pretty much had it summed up. What they failed to do, really, was to be able to implement it. And one of the reasons that I think they found was that it's one thing to talk in your ivory tower about what nationalism means and to have this sort of republic of letters. It's another thing to begin to actually put it into practice and to, you know, to spread the good news. Because the minute you start to disseminate things and it becomes a more popular movement in terms of the numbers, obviously it becomes diluted. The message becomes diluted and in some ways more radical. You have to simplify it. Everything becomes a bit more tabloid, if I can put it that way, rather than deep. And it was always a problem. It was always a problem for them. They could not reconcile this. You know, on the one hand, we want to educate everyone, but actually to educate millions of people means in some ways we have to simplify everything. How do you simplify everything? Well, it starts to go into sort of catchphrases, if I can put it that way. I mean, it loses meaning. So as you expand, the meaning becomes diluted. And I think, you know, that's where the project in some ways hit what we might term sort of friction. It wasn't able to achieve all that it wanted to achieve in the first instance, at least.
Turning to more recent history, how do you think Ahmadinejad has been able to use nationalist sentiments to both maintain his own power internally and exert Iranian influence abroad.
Well, what's remarkable about Ahmadinejad is he's really been the most singular nationalist leader in post-revolutionary Iran. He's been able to do things that previous presidents simply have not been able to do. And part of that is his character. Part of that is because he comes from a very sort of hardline political background, so he's able to get away with it, whereas others on the sort of the center or the center left were not. They were always accused of forsaking the Islamic Revolution. And Ahmadinejad, for the reasons that I sort of cited earlier, because of the failures of that Islamic legitimacy or the failures of the democratic republican legitimacy that they'd enjoyed, really went full scale in search of a nationalist ideological sort of platform and legitimacy. And he's used it in an extraordinary way. I mean, to the extent that he's not been shy about using pre-Islamic symbols, not been shy about, having mock-ups of Persepolis to greet President Putin in 2007 as he was. He arranged for the Cyrus cylinder to return to Iran for the first time since the Shah had his notorious, but at the time is great bonanza in Persepolis for the 2500th anniversary of the Iranian monarchy. And you know, when you see the video of this unveiling of the Cyrus cylinder in Tehran, I mean, you think that Ahmadinejad is almost in tears. What he does, of course, is he says Cyrus, you know, the great pre-Islamic founder of the Persian Empire. He basically defines him as a sort of a pseudo-Muslim. I mean, it's quite entertaining how he tries to marry these several different strands together, and he legitimizes Cyrus, but by basically arguing that he's a Muslim before Islam, and therefore he's legitimate. But of course, for many Orthodox Muslims in Iran, particularly in the hardline government, they all find this a bit strange, and they don't like it. But in a way, they see Ahmadinejad as trying to keep the people on board. It does, of course, give you a very good indication of where popular sentiment lies these days, that the government thinks it's necessary to go down that route.
In recent years, there have been several confrontations that Ahmadinejad has had with the religious leaders in Iran. Do you think he'll be able to maintain his power and his popularity, or do you think that people will stop siding with him?
I think Ahmadinejad's popularity was always a little bit artificial. He had a strong support from the supreme leader. He had strong support from the various hardline organizations and government. He spoke, in a way that appealed popular sentiment. But of course, at the end of the day, he's made a complete mess of the economy. He hasn't handled the international relations particularly well. All this populism has really come to naught. And just as this sort of support that he had, in my view, was always very soft, so too, when going gets hard, he'll start to lose it. I think nationalism is a great, great mobilizer in Iran, but you also have to be a credible champion of it. And one of the parallels and comparisons I draw is that the last Shah in the run-up to the revolution spoke in increasingly religious terms. I mean, he spoke in very spiritual and mystical terms, dreams, and so on and so forth. I think people never saw the Shah as a credible sort of representative of the true religion. And I don't think that people see the leaders of the Islamic Republic as credible representations of Iranian nationalism. They've released that genie out of the bottle yet again. I think they would have had difficulty suppressing it, to be honest, but it's now come out full strength. And I don't think that Ahmadinejad will be able to ride that tiger for much longer.
Do you think there are currently any leaders or potential leaders in Iran who could fill that role as credible nationalist leader?
I think there are a number. I mean, I think there are a number even within the Islamic Republic. I mean, the longer this goes on, the more difficult it becomes. But, you know, for example, Khatami had always represented a strong enlightenment project in Iran, not entirely understood by everyone. But he had the mantra, and he was the one that promoted the mantra, Iran for all Iranians. I mean, this is actually in some ways the first time that such a bold statement had been made. Of course, Ahmadinejad, ironically, given his, quote, nationalism, rejected this. You know, this idea of Iran for all Iranians was a bizarre statement as far as they were concerned, which, you know, contradicts his nationalist credentials. But I think there are others who quite clearly have a much more nationalistic approach and probably more credibility. Now, you know, whether future leadership, you know, will come from the established, you know, the known quantities in the Islamic Republic or from elsewhere is something I'm, you know, not clear on. I certainly think that in the first instance, it's probably more likely to come from leaders in the Islamic Republic who are currently categorized as dissidents, by the way, but, you know, they will be seen as certainly more in tune with the national interests. So even someone like Mir Hossein Mousavi, by no means a perfect choice, but nonetheless someone who's been under house arrest, who may have won the election in 2009, he could basically, you know, certainly be brought out of house arrest and basically asked to head up a government of national unity, for instance. In fact, Rafsanjani has already said that. Rafsanjani has tried to promote a government of national unity. Whether that's credible, of course, in terms of the popular mood, is another matter. But certainly, I think the people will, you know, are not keen really for a major political upheaval in that sense, and will probably go for a degree of compromise as long as it also had sufficient credibility for them to believe it.
You mentioned earlier that Iran has a educated and literate middle class. In the near future, do you see them being able to participate more in the political arena in Iran?
Well, I think if Iran is ever to be able to reach its full potential in a political and economic sense, it will have to. I mean, it's just a simple fact. I think under Rafsanjani and Khatami, they used these people very much in a technocratic sense. That is, you know, get involved, but don't get involved in politics. Just get involved in running the country, administration rather than political. I think in the future, if they really want to make the most out of the potential Iran has, they will have to allow a degree of participation in the politics of the country, not just in the administration. At the moment, they're not involved in the politics or the administration, which is why the whole thing is just such a disaster. I mean, even if you look at the central bank or other things, I mean, you see that actually the people in charge are clearly quite incompetent and aren't able really to handle things. Eventually, you know, what they will ask, I suspect, is they will ask these people to come back to sort of like administer. My sense is they will say, well, no, we're not just going to come back and administer. We want certain rights. And this is the interesting thing. There is always a question mark, but, you know, they will play the nationalist card and say, your country needs you. I think the critical factor will be is they will say, good, my country needs me, but this is what I want in return. And the minute they say that will be the moment when Iranian political maturity, if I can put it that way, begins.
Obviously, in recent history, the past year and a half, the Arab Spring has been the big news out of the Middle East. Do you see something in that vein potentially taking hold in Iran, or do you think the state is too strong and would be able to control such a popular uprising?
I think the state is strong, but it's fragile, and it's becoming increasingly fragile. So in some ways, or another word people use is brittle. So it has all the veneer of this strength. It has a strong coercive force. It has a fairly corrupt judiciary that basically does as it's told. It's not afraid to use force. But on the other hand, it's weak in a number of areas. Economically, it's weak. It's not popular by any stretch of the imagination. People have a deep suspicion of it. If you look at the run and the rial, for instance, recently, is this purely an economic crisis? I don't think so. I think this is a crisis of confidence. It's a crisis of political confidence, principally, that people are saying, we don't trust you anymore. We don't think you have the solutions. And therefore, they're running for cover in the dollar or whatever else they're looking for. So there are serious structural problems there. And if you listen to the likes of people like Nikki Keddie and others who work on revolutions in Iran, they'll tell you that Iran, in the 20th century at least, has been amongst the most revolutionary of countries. I see no reason for that to change. I think the government is well aware of this, which is why it constantly huffs and puffs and says that, you know, any repression, any uprising will be crushed. I think sooner or later, this cycle of protests that we've seen from, you know, from 1906, or let's say 1892, 1906, then the 1950s or earlier, 79, and then the sequence, you know, it normally happens maybe a generation every 10 years. It's happening, I have to say, with increasing frequency. And I think this reflects also the intensity of the problems, the education of the public, other factors that previous generations did not have, the means of communication, technology, all sorts of things mean that actually ideas are being circulated much more vigorously than ever before. And if you combine that with the economic malaise that is clearly setting in, it's a recipe for a certain amount of combustion.
Well, Ali, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. Before I let you go, could you talk for a few minutes about what projects you're currently working on?
Well, at the moment, one of the things that interested me when I did this project was really historiography, and I was always interested in the way in which nationalists had sort of defined history in Iran, how they saw their historical legacy and how that fed into identity. And I think one of the areas I want to really explore more, and I think there's an enormous amount that can be done. There's so much literature coming out of Iran now. I mean, a lot of papers, documents, collections that it would have been quite difficult to get hold of previously over the last few decades, and certainly through the hard work of a number of individuals in Iran, have now been published and are now much more accessible. It also helps, of course, that the rial is so weak in Iran today, because it means a lot of this stuff is now purchasable and we can bring it abroad. But it means that for scholars and historians of Iran, there's a lot more material there available. It means that a project looking at the uses and abuses of history, if I can put it that way, in modern Iran becomes much more feasible and much more accessible. So that's really where I'm looking at, and I have a number of projects. I think the next one really is to look at how particular moments in Iranian history have been interpreted and reinterpreted by Iranian historians in the 20th century, and how they've been used and abused for political purposes.
Excellent. That sounds very interesting. And thank you again for talking with me today.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another episode of New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. And thanks again to Ali Ansari for taking the time to talk with me today about his book, The Politics of Nationalism in Modern Iran. You can follow New Books in Middle Eastern Studies on Twitter, where we are at New Books Mideast, and also on Facebook, as well as through our website, newbooksinmiddleeasternstudies.com, where you can find links to subscribe to our show. To send me your comments or to suggest an author or book for a future show, you can use the contact information that is provided on the show's website. Also, if you enjoy the shows, please take a moment to rate them on iTunes, which will help more people find our shows. Thank you for listening.